From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, President Obama is sending hundreds of military advisors to Iraq. A U.S. research organization considers the cost of the Iraq war. Global forced displacement is reported at the highest since World War II.
All these conflicts are not only creating a dramatic humanitarian situation, but they represent today a major threat to global peace and security.
And hardy World Cup fans camp along Brazil's beaches. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. President Barack Obama is sending 300 U.S. military advisors to Iraq to help that government fight Islamist insurgents. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez has details.
President Obama has been under pressure to respond to the advances made by militants who last week came dangerously close to the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. On Thursday, the president outlined the steps the administration is taking to support Iraqi security forces.
We have had advisors in Iraq through our embassy, and we're prepared to send a small number of additional American military advisors, up to 300, to assess how we can best train, advise, and support Iraqi security forces going forward.
The teams are special operators whose first job will be to assess Iraq's security forces. Officials say scores of them will be arriving in Baghdad soon. The troops are already at bases in the general region. President Obama says the United States will intensify its intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance support for the Iraqis. Retired U.S. Army General Jack Keane says Iraq urgently needs an intelligence apparatus like the one U.S. forces had in place before they pulled out of Iraq in 2011.
And we would download all of our national theater and local intelligence systems so we have true situational awareness. Military term that tells you what is the enemy doing, where is the enemy, who, what, when, where. And we need that. When we pulled out of there in 2011, that screen for Maliki went blank. We took all that capability with us, never left any of it there for him. We have to put that back.
The president said targeted military action is possible in the future, but he emphasized that this is not another open-ended commitment of U.S. forces in Iraq.
American forces will not be returning to combat in Iraq, but we will help Iraqis as they take the fight to terrorists who threaten the Iraqi people, the region, and American interests as well.
President Obama called on the leadership of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to govern with a more inclusive agenda in order to prevent Iraq from descending into an all-out civil war. The president said it is not up to America to decide who Iraq's leaders should be. The 300 advisors will be in addition to the 275 troops the president has committed to help safeguard the American embassy and other U.S. interests in the country. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
The U.S. is considering working with Iran on the crisis in Iraq, but the Pentagon says it has no plans to enter into military cooperation with the Iranians in any action in Iraq. A top State Department official says U.S. and Iranian diplomats met briefly Monday on the sidelines of nuclear talks in Vienna. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told Yahoo News that the Iranians have to be prepared to do something to respect Iraqi integrity and sovereignty before Washington makes a decision on how to proceed. Soner Çaptay is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. In the second part of our report, VOA's Dahil Shamo asks about U.S.-Iranian cooperation on Iraq.
The idea is to get Iran engaged in Iraq so it will militarily assist the Iraqi government, take over the north. I think that would be actually going against the idea of preventing sectarian warfare. Iranian influence in the north of that country, north of Syria, is going to be seen as playing into ISIS's main narrative, that this is a Shiite-Sunni war, and inviting Iranians to establish order in Sunni-dominated north is going to be seen as inviting a Shiite element to the Sunni-dominated north. So I think it actually will accentuate the sectarian element of this conflict, and I don't think it will bring stability to Iraq.
Let's talk about the role of Turkey and where Turkey stands in this situation. We've seen that the U.S. is ready to engage Iran, to talk with Iran. On the other side, we hear that the British are announcing that they will reopen their embassy in Iran, in Tehran. In these developments, where do you see Turkey? Where is Turkey stand?
Turkey's sidelined to a large extent. It's not a kingmaker in Iraqi or Syrian politics. It does not have any influence in Baghdad or Damascus. In fact, if you look at Turkey's neighborhood, you realize that following the demise of Turkish-Israeli ties, Not only today, Turkey has no ambassador in Israel, but it also has no ambassador in Damascus. Its ambassador in Cairo is not received well because of the fallout of Turkish-Egyptian ties. Turkey supported the government of Morsi, and when he was ousted, obviously, that was a big fallout in Turkish-Egyptian ties. I would add that Turkish-Israeli ties will probably normalize before Turkish-Egyptian ties, and that shows you how bad Turkish-Egyptian ties are. And now Turkey's consulate in Basra has been evacuated. Turkey's consulate in Mosul has been taken over by ISIS. So Turkey is fast losing diplomatic traction in this region. It has almost no allies left in its immediate neighborhood. And within the background of U.S.-Iran talks for a nuclear deal, if the U.S. were to ask for Iranian engagement in Iraq to pacify the unrest in the north, the Turks would see this as even closer U.S.-Iranian cooperation, and they'll be very confused, that they'll be feeling that they'll be left alone. And I think we saw a while ago that Turkey decided to buy air defense systems. Part of that was because Turkey wanted to transfer Chinese technology, which is air defense technology. But the other part of it was Turkey's way of showing to the United States that it does have the ability to go and get alternative allies when it's left alone. So I think Turkey might feel even more alone and isolated if an Iran-US deal goes through and Iran is also invited to provide order and put down the ISIS movement in northern Iraq.
Is what's happening now, right now in Mosul, in the Sunni regions, a beginning of a civil war in the region, not only in Iraq?
I think what we're seeing in Iraq is an insurgency. It's Sunni insurgency against the Maliki government. Obviously, this is similar but not the same as the insurgency in Syria. The insurgency in Syria is also a Sunni insurgency, but it's led by a majority of that country's population against a minority-backed regime. In Iraq, it's a minority insurgency against the majority. But nevertheless, these are insurgencies, and I think they're increasingly merging together in the sense that fighters from one country are crossing to the other. And we are seeing, let's say, in the Northern Fertile Crescent, from Lebanon to Iraq to Syria, the three countries are increasingly merging in their conflicts, where you have Lebanese Shia fighting for the Assad regime in Syria, and Iraqi Sunnis are fighting with the Sunni insurgents in Syria against the Ba'ath regime in Damascus. And it's not to say that this is all one big conflict. I think there's still the war in Syria, which is different than the situation in Iraq. But we are seeing two insurgencies in two different countries. And they're actually, the way the countries are next to each other and their ethnic communities are merging in terms of look at the conflict, I think we're increasingly moving in a trajectory where the growth of ISIS in Iraq is an Iraqi phenomena. But ISIS came to occupy Iraq from Syria. We should not forget that. Originally, of course, let's also not forget that ISIS went to Syria from Iraq. So ironically, it was exported from Iraq into Syria. Now it's coming back from Syria to Iraq to occupy Iraq.
Soner Joptay is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. You can hear more of his remarks this weekend on Press Conference USA here on The Voice of America, or listen on our website at voanews.com under podcasts. The National Priorities Project, a nonprofit research group, has taken a look at U.S. federal spending in the Iraq War and argues Americans oppose sending combat forces back. We spoke with NPP research analyst Jasmine Tucker about their findings.
We have spent more than $816 billion on military action in Iraq since 2003. And over these years, you know, hundreds of billion dollars, not to mention many American lives. And so really, we need to turn our focus inward and address the many problems that we have domestically.
What would you spend the money on domestically?
A variety of things. The American people say they want to support investment in programs like public education, in jobs, food assistance, health care. I mean, you name it. Anything else but military spending, really, the American people want to see our money spent on.
And you don't believe that Americans want us to go back into Iraq on the ground?
Polling shows that 74% of Americans oppose sending combat troops back into Iraq. And more than half of Americans say that they want to see military spending draw down over the next few years.
Do you have any projections on what it might cost us if, say, we went into an airstrike war in Iraq?
We haven't costed that out yet. I think we're waiting to see what the president and what congressional leaders think is going to be the best course of action. But even if we're talking about another $100 billion, we're not even factoring in the cost that we're going to incur due to interest on our national debt. We don't factor that into the cost of war. And we also don't factor in the billions of dollars that we then have to spend taking care of our veterans when they return from the conflict.
How do you do your research?
So we pulled data from the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, from the White House to cost out what exactly. So we have to piece together a few things when we're talking about the cost of war. We have to piece together some military spending. We have to piece together nuclear weapon spending, which comes out of energy and environment. So we have to sort of cobble together costs from several different departments to put the cost of war numbers together.
Now, your report says that the President Obama and the U.S. Congress should look for ways to be helpful in the Iraq crisis that don't involve combat operations. Do you have any suggestions what some of those might be?
That's a great question. You know, this is the war in Iraq. It's not our fight. You know, the folks there have been battling one another for years before we even got there. And so we need to be talking about diplomacy or other, you know, non-military action ways to be helpful to them that doesn't involve putting our troops on the ground or airstriking, because people don't want a war. The American people don't want to send troops in. So we should be thinking about diplomacy or other potentially peaceful ways to interact with them.
Jasmine Tucker, a research analyst for the National Priorities Project.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. VOAnews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. VOAnews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Politicians worldwide often vilify their opponents, and those in Nigeria are no different. As the 2015 elections approach, Nigeria's two main political parties are blaming each other for the violent Boko Haram insurgency in the north. As Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja, analysts say neither party is wholly to blame, but individual politicians from both parties could partially be funding the group.
In the past 5 years, Boko Haram militants have killed thousands of people, and as next year's elections draw near, the insurgency appears to be growing. More than 2,000 people have been killed this year alone in attacks on markets, military bases, bus stations, and even football viewing centers. In April, the Islamist radical group kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls. At his home in the Niger Delta, Avi Joseph, a local leader within the ruling People's Democratic Party, or PDP, says the opposition funds the violence, trying to make the country ungovernable.
Where problems of kidnapping, Boko Haram, all that are coming, is a style of trying to destabilize the ruling party and its opposition.
He says Boko Haram's increasing strength is evidence that wealthy politicians must be supporting the group. The opposition he speaks of is the All Progressive Congress, or APC, a mega party formed last year when several opposition parties merged. Analysts say if the party can stand behind a single candidate next year, it could prove to be a formidable opponent to the PDP, which has governed Nigeria since 1999. Christian Ononjacha is the assistant secretary of the APC in Delta State. He blames the ruling party for failing to stop the insurgency.
What they are now trying to do is to throw the blame on us that we are involved. But we are not involved. We are not in charge of the federal security apparatus. They are in charge.
He says the ruling party is wasting time pointing fingers when it should be fighting the insurgency. He concedes that individual politicians may be involved, but he thinks they are from the ruling party.
Our members are clean. They are people that we know can salvage this nation from the quagmire that it is currently.
But some analysts say that on this issue, both parties are correct and both are wrong. Jan St-Pierre, the CEO of Berlin-based security consulting firm Mosicon, says Nigerian politicians often hire thugs to intimidate their opposition.
Both sides use them depending on how greedy or ambitious the local politician was. They would sometimes use more of their services, sometimes less, but both sides, all parties were.
St-Pierre says the politicians may not be interested in Boko Haram's goals, but in northeastern Nigeria, the Boko Haram members happen to be the guys with the guns. The group is believed to be controlling villages along the Chad and Cameroon borders, he says. And in those areas, even conducting an election will require support from Boko Haram.
They intimidate, they terrorize, and when possible, they actually provide goods and services, which gives them the legitimacy that sometimes, despite everything that they're doing, that the government doesn't seem to have.
Boko Haram's name means Western education is sinful, and the group has threatened President Goodluck Jonathan by name. However, St-Pierre says while Boko Haram may be partially supported by a corrupt political system, the insurgents probably do not care who wins. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
A UN investigator reports about 4,000 Eritreans are fleeing the country every month to escape indefinite national service, arbitrary arrest, and other persistent violations of their human rights. Last year, about 2,000 people fled Eritrea every month in search of asylum. That number now has doubled. Sheila Keithra calls this 50% spike shocking.
It shows the level of despair. Hope is outside, even if it is very difficult. The route to reach that is very difficult in terms of, you know, death in the desert or drowning at sea. So that's quite shocking. What is shocking also is that people know those risks. And it's like we take it because there is no other choice.
The UN Refugee Agency reports 13,000 Eritreans have arrived in Italy by boat since the beginning of the year, accounting for 32% of all arrivals in the European country. What is pushing Eritreans to leave is the pervasive and brutal abuse of their rights, according to Keithra's report. She says people, above all, are fleeing to escape the country's system of national service. Originally designed as compulsory military service for a limited period of time, Keithra says it has been transformed into a system of indefinite forced labor.
Originally, it was meant for 18 months, and at the moment, it has become an indefinite situation where people are conscripted for 14, 15, 20 years, from the age of 18 up to 50 years. Indefinite national service. The whole population is conscripted, so it is in fact not a sustainable long-term solution in terms of running the country.
The UN investigator cites what she calls guilt by association, as the families of those who flee are punished by having to pay a fine or be detained. She says detention centers are severely overcrowded and are often underground cells or shipping containers, which are extremely hot. She says people receive little food and hygiene is horrific. The UN Refugee Agency's annual Global Trends report says more than 50 million people were forcibly displaced by the conflict at the end of last year, the highest number since World War II. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report at UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
As the world marks World Refugee Day, these staggering figures are nothing to celebrate. Of the more than 50 million people forcibly displaced, the report finds 16.7 million are refugees, and more than twice that number, or 33.3 million, are people displaced within their own countries. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Antonio Guterres says these growing numbers are a result of the multiplication of new crises. He says the alarming spectacle of seeing millions of people forced to flee for their lives confirms the inability of nations to resolve or prevent conflict.
All these conflicts are not only creating a dramatic humanitarian situation, but they represent today a major threat to global peace and security, a threat that is felt everywhere. So solidarity with today's refugees is not only a matter of generosity, it is, as I usually say, more and more a matter of enlightened self-interest.
The report finds the massive increase in forcible displacement last year was driven mainly by the war in Syria. With 2.5 million Syrian refugees and 6.5 million internally displaced. The report says major new displacement also has occurred in Africa, notably in Central African Republic and South Sudan. Overall, the biggest refugee populations under UNHCR care are Afghans, Syrians, and Somalis. They account for more than half of the global refugee total. The United Nations notes 50% of the world's displaced are children. The report says more than 1 million people have sought asylum in 2013, most in developed countries. They include a record 25,300 claims from separated or unaccompanied children. Though most asylum claims are made in the West, High Commissioner Guterres says the perception that all refugees are fleeing to wealthy northern countries in search of a better life and not for protection is false.
The truth is that 86% of the world's refugees live in the developing world. And again, this is the highest percentage since the beginning of the century, and it compares to 70% only 10 years ago. So the trend in the world is not only to have more and more refugees, but to have more and more refugees staying in the developing world.
While the forcible displacement crisis continues to escalate, the UNHCR says its ability to find long-term solutions for these people is waning. It says last year it only succeeded in voluntarily returning 414,600 refugees to their homes of origin, representing the fourth lowest level of refugee returns in almost a quarter century. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Put your flags up in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
Thousands of football fans are camping out in Brazil during the month-long World Cup. Many are living out of cars and campers along Rio de Janeiro's famed beaches. VOA's Scott Bob has their story.
Copacabana's Avenue of the Americas. These fans from Argentina are preparing for the day's games. They drove for 3 days from their home in Córdoba, 3,000 kilometers away, in order to be part of the World Cup. They live out of this delivery truck in one of Rio's most sought-after parking areas. Guillermo Juri is one of them. We had to wait a couple of hours, then we got lucky. The spot became available, so we parked here, facing the beach, just meters from the fan fest. We are very comfortable. Thousands of fans are choosing to rough it in vehicles that range from the luxurious to the utilitarian, and even historic. Why? So they can afford tickets to the games, which cost hundreds of dollars. Lucas Valinotti heats water with his car's cigarette lighter. The food is basic, but no Argentine will forego his daily mate, the herb-infused tea that is the national drink. He says he will never forget this experience.
We are really enjoying it. You hear 20, 30, 40 different languages at the same time. I've met people that I would have never met in my life, and I took pictures with some crazy ones. This is great.
They sleep anywhere they can. Franco Jofre from Buenos Aires says he and his two friends squeeze into his compact when it rains. Otherwise, they sleep on the sidewalk. Jofre says they bathe in the public bathrooms. The main problem is that there are only 30 toilets for thousands of fans who gather here. But no one seems to mind.
Everywhere is happy, everywhere wants to chat to other people, meet new people. It's just great. It's the World Cup, you know? And it's an amazing event, just the biggest event on our time of history, you know?
Some illegally parked vehicles have been fined or towed. But for these fans, it's worth it. Others pay hundreds of dollars a night for hotel rooms with this view. Here, the view is free, even though it's curbside. Scott Bob, VOA News, Rio de Janeiro.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.